Welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that brings some of the most interesting, inspirational, and intelligent people on the planet directly to you so you can listen to a conversation that is sure to make a difference in your life. And that's really what we're trying to do, make a difference in the lives of people for time and for eternity. I've often talked about the three great apologetic issues, the first being the issue of origins. How one views their origins will inevitably determine how they live their life. If you feel as though you're a function of random chance, you're going to live your life by a different standard than if you know that you're created in the image of God and accountable to Him. Now, obviously, in a Christian worldview, the God who spoke and the universe leapt into existence condescended to reveal Himself in time and space and demonstrated that He was in fact God through the immutable fact of His resurrection, something that we do not have to believe through blind faith, but rather can adhere to on the basis of faith founded on a refutable fact. And then within the Christian worldview, we also consider the Bible to be a reliable authority. And once again, we do not do that blindly. We do that because the Bible is demonstrably reliable. And so the issue of apologetics is of transcendent importance to the historic Christian faith. And I'm constantly looking for people who are able to articulate the great apologetic issues in a compelling fashion for our generation. We're not responsible for the last generation. We don't know what will happen in a future generation. But we are responsible for making a difference in this generation. And so I'm constantly looking for people who are interesting and inspirational and intelligent. And lo and behold, I found such a person in Northern Ireland. He wrote a book called New Atheism. His name is Graham Veal, and he is extraordinarily enthusiastic about introducing apologetics to young people. And I really care about that because young people live in an age of information overload and oftentimes cannot discern between wheat and chaff and heat and light. And so we need great apologists who can equip a younger generation to look through the potholes which are laid before them as traps in a new atheistic environment. And Graham Veal is just such a person. He holds graduate and postgraduate degrees in theology from Queen's University, Belfast. He's taught religious education for many, many years, almost two decades. And as I just mentioned, he is the author of a book that I came across. That's how I learned about him. It's titled New Atheism, A Survival Guide. And Graham Veal now joins me from Northern Ireland. He's in the midst of a major snowstorm. But I'm glad you have joined us for this podcast, Graham.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to be here. Hank, it's what we call a major snowstorm in Ireland. It's about 4 or 5 centimeters of snow, but we'll survive.
And it closes down the whole country, right?
Oh, yeah, pretty much. We just don't like anything that looks remotely like bad weather. We'll survive.
I mean, all I know about Northern Ireland is it's a great place to play golf.
Yeah, we have some very good golf courses, fairly close together in Northern Ireland, so we produce some fairly good golfers over the year. I personally, I've tried it once and was a danger to everyone on the field, including myself. But there's supposed to be some very good golf around here.
I loved your book, and of course I had you on the broadcast talking about New Atheism, and I think the title in and of itself is very intriguing. But before I get to that, your passion for equipping this generation of young people.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem that we live with now is the Twitter generation. I've been reading what people have called postmortems of New Atheism. So people think that the publishing phenomenon of New Atheism has gone, but through Twitter, through different stand-up comedians like Ricky Gervais, I mean, a lot of these atheist memes, atheist arguments have been diluted down and dumbed down even further, if that was possible. And so young Christian young people live in a fairly hostile environment and can be continually bombarded with arguments and sneers and all sorts of things that would be pressuring them to give up on their faith. And the really sad thing here is that there really is, behind these arguments, there's not an awful lot of strength. There's not an awful lot of reasoning. And then on the other side of the equation is you have people who are, who are unevangelized, people who really haven't been reached effectively with the gospel. And when they do encounter the gospel, have almost been pre-programmed, by what's online to reject it as a fantastic fairy tale. So there's two sides of the coin here to try to, encourage Christian young people in their faith and also trying to reach out to those outside it, those outside the faith. So that's been something I've been passionate about and something that I've, tried very hard to engage young people with.
It's interesting, and you mentioned the word sneer. I mean, there's peer pressure, and young people feel a tremendous amount of peer pressure, but you also talk about what you just alluded to, the sense of sneer pressure, where the Christian faith is sneered at. It's looked at as though it is infantile. It is for those who've lost their brains somewhere in the narthex of a church. So people are belittled and in that way driven away from the Christian faith.
Yes, I mean, Dawkins and company were particularly good at this, at looking down their nose and, young people are used to going into lecture theatres or schoolrooms and dealing with authority figures. And teachers quite often, I think because we encounter so much prima facie scepticism and cynicism from young people, we forget how much authority we have. And when authority figures sneer at an idea and won't even begin to engage with an idea because they just decide and pronounce that this is ridiculous, it can be very difficult to get a conversation started. To me, the best thing is to call it out for what it is. This is a bluff. Before you sneer at me, you've got to earn the right to do that. You've got to present to me why it is that you think this worldview that I hold is so ridiculous. And that quite often is not done. Certainly, I mean, Ricky Gervais in particular would I worry about the effect that he would have on young people and people like him, just this continual sneering, this idea that if you've done any sort of reading, if you've cracked the spine of any book, then you couldn't take the Christian faith seriously. And I think another thing that we need to work out quite hard is the credulity of young people who will just, quite often just give in very, very quickly, to the first thing that they come across on Twitter, to the first thing, the first argument they come across on YouTube. And so, yeah, there's a strong sense of a rhetorical strategy that I would pick up, but a strong sense of a rhetorical strategy out there to try and demean Christianity before you can even get a conversation going. And I think that that's something that needs to be challenged quite strongly by the church.
There's so much information. We live in an age of information overload for certain, and people are not taught to think critically. And I don't really know what you would say in terms of solutions for teaching young people to think critically. How can that be done within the context of the current educational environment and the church?
In terms of the church, I think the most important thing is role models. And by the church, I don't just mean pastors, I mean parents as well. Youth leaders, obviously, but I think quite often, I mean, a parent can have much more of an impact than a youth pastor. Now, that might be heretical in some circles to say that, and youth pastors are very important, but the primary role here is that of a parent. And people with parental roles within the church, not just the person who's a paid professional, youth pastor. So I think that those people who are spending time with young people need to model this in their own lives so that they are not just grabbing the first argument themselves that they see when they hit in Google. So if a young person comes to them with a question, why should I believe in God? Your approach, if you're working with young people, cannot be to Google why should I believe in God and go to the first argument, which happens to suit you, and throw that back to a Christian young person. You've got to go away and take thought and show them that you're taking thought and come back to them and say, well, I looked into your question and I looked at this and I looked at that, and here's why I reached my conclusion, or here's And when people are modeling that sort of critical thinking in the home, and when pastors are prepared to do it in the pulpit, then young people can pick up on those habits. There's an awful lot that just cannot be taught from a blackboard or an interactive whiteboard. An awful lot of what young people need to learn needs to be actually shown to them and lived out in front of them. And I really think that that includes critical thinking. Now, obviously, that means somebody has to sit down. People have to sit and read books on this. And when people read books on this, they need to share it with those who, you know, this needs to be shared out and passed around the church. But if you really want to get this into a young person's life, the best way to do it isn't to hand them a book. It's to actually demonstrate it yourself continually. So that's how I see the church dealing with it. Education, again, I think it's a similar process where teachers have to show this in their classroom, have to continually model this and try to show young people that you just don't jump on the first, you know, the first article that you happen to come across which suits your agenda or suits your point of view.
Talk for a moment about the implications of the new atheism. In other words, they're making incredible inroads into churches, actually. They're making incredible inroads, as we just talked about, in terms of the educational environment. But what kind of traction do they have at the end of the day? Are they winning the war? Are they ahead in the game, so to speak? Are they really advancing over what the old atheists do? I mean, you write about the new atheists, but how are the new atheists doing in comparison to the old atheists?
New atheism, I think, largely approached this debate with a sense of intellectual superiority. They assumed that the debate was over. They assumed that there was no debate to be had with Christianity or any religion, that they were right, that everybody else was wrong. They did this at a time, actually, when Christianity is probably stronger in the academy than it has been for a century, which might explain why they took that particular approach. And there was a strong commitment to scientism, to the idea that science had the answers to all these existential questions, which is to say, there are no answers because science doesn't provide any. To the extent that new atheism was a publishing phenomenon, I think that sense of new atheism is probably over. You know, Jerry Coyne and a few others have tried to follow on from where Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett, where those guys started. Others have tried to follow and haven't had quite the same success. But I think as a worldview, I think as an approach to this debate, I think it has actually seeped into the DNA of how people, and particularly young people, approach these debates, because it will come up much more likely now in, for example, Stephen Fry. There's a famous clip on him in The Problem of Evil, in which he simply restated the problem of evil and declared the argument over. You know, Ricky Gervais, if you watch him in late night shows, continually has a go at the existence of God, and he's using new atheist arguments, but without the book-length treatment. And I think this is actually a remarkable accomplishment. They've actually managed to dumb down new atheism. Now, that's incredible. It was a dumbed-down version of atheism to begin with. So my sense is that out there, these arguments that were started off by Richard Dawkins, which were popularized in these books, have seeped into the DNA of many people who are, you know, writing tweets, you know, who have their YouTube videos in particular. And this actually concerns me, the amount that our young people learn from YouTube and the amount that is absorbed through YouTube. YouTube can be a wonderful tool, but if somebody doesn't have a roadmap going in there, it can be a scary place. And the sort of propaganda you'll get there in a five-minute video clip on YouTube, it's been taken straight from these books, straight from this new atheist philosophy. So to some extent, that mindset has done very, very well, is still with us, and to some extent is much more difficult to challenge now that you don't have, you know, these guys out pushing their latest book on atheism. It's a bit more subtle, but it's alive and well, and it's something, again, that needs to be continually challenged.
It certainly does, and, you know, there is this idea within culture today that Christianity and science have always been at odds with one another. And I think this is one of the things that has to be dispelled in terms of mythology.
Oh, yes. I mean, I've pointed this out in a number of debates, but one of the things that I would try and clarify is that the first scientists were Christian, or came from a Christian point of view, or a Christian worldview. And that isn't just an accident. This is sometimes portrayed as, well, of course they were Christian. They lived, you know, back in the 1600s. You know, what choice did they have? As a matter of fact, that is neither here nor there. Misses the point completely. These guys were scientists because they were Christian, and it was their Christianity which had a direct impact on the birth of science itself. I mean, you have to have a very finely tuned view of human reason to get science off the ground. You have to believe that we live in a rationally ordered universe. You have to believe that we are smart enough to know what is going on in that universe to at least some extent. But we are not smart enough to work it out by sitting in our armchairs. We can make mistakes. We're flawed. So we have to go out and check our ideas by experimentation and observation. Now, that's actually a very finely tuned view of human reason there, which fits in very neatly with the idea of human beings made in the image of God, yet who were damaged in the fall. So human reason, while it is reliable, can be a flawed instrument which has to be checked. And also the mathematical view of the universe, the idea that mathematics can, you know, the guy sitting in his house working on a mathematical formula can go out and use those mathematical formulas to explain and describe the world around him. You know, that implies that there is a great mathematician who has this whole universe ordered and planned. But it's not just that belief in a divine architect. It's the belief that, yes, our minds can follow his mind, but we're fallen creatures, and therefore we need this experimental method. We need to do experiments. We need to check our ideas, because there is a God, but we're not him. There is a God, but we're not gods. We're fallen creatures. And if we look at some of the work in the history of science, it's this idea of a fall, and we're fallen, and we need to check authorities. We can't just accept what our ancestors said or what's in tradition. We have to come back and we have to check and look over it again with experiment. Becomes extremely, you can't get science off the ground without these things. So the idea that Christianity Christianity and science are somehow at loggerheads, and that one is always doomed to destroy the other, I mean, that's absolute nonsense. You'll struggle to find any textbook in the history of science that would seriously make that argument. You'll find it in popular literature. You'll find it on the internet. But, I mean, you're not going to find serious historians saying this. I mean, to take one final example. Usually people will go back and attack Christianity, and they'll go back and say, look, you know, the fossil record, and they'll get into debates about the origins of the species and all sorts of things about the origins of the Earth. And my big question is, why is it that we are interested in the history of our planet? If you look at Plato, if you look at Aristotle, if you look at the ancient Greeks, they weren't remotely interested in the history of the planet Earth, because they assumed that it had been around forever and would be around forever. But it was only when you get Christians who believe that history is important, history has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and has a meaning, that's when you actually get guys going back and starting to look at the age of the Earth and begin to look at what is this history? What does this teach us about our Creator? So this idea that Christianity and science are at loggerheads, it's horrifying to me that so many people have bought into this. And it's horrifying to me the number of Christians who will buy into this and will almost either have a fear of science or will, you know, be somehow reticent to enter into these debates in any way. Science, to me, the success of science is one of the, it's a vindicating factor. It's a vindicating evidence for Christianity, because this is something that only started in a Christian culture and could not have started with the Greek free of reason. And the Romans didn't even attempt anything like this. You need a very, very, very specific set of beliefs before you can get science off the ground. And Christianity provides that ground, provides that fertility, provides that, you know, provides the nutrients that science needs to get up and running.
Yeah, I think that point has to be emphasized, Graham. The fact that science could only have arisen within the context of a Christian worldview. It certainly could not have arisen within the worldview of the Greeks, who believed that the universe was ministered by moody gods. It took a Christian worldview to give rise to science, and therefore to think that science and scripture, or science and Christianity, are loggerheads, as you put it, is irrational to begin with. And it belies a misunderstanding of history.
It really does. I mean, it isn't even polytheism. If you can even take Plato's theism or his view of the universe, where, you know, there is a rational structure to it, but he believed that you could sit, you know, in your armchair and work out all you needed to know. It actually takes something like Christianity to come along and say, no, you might be smart, but you're not God. And God, by the way, is free to make the universe any way he likes. So you can't sit in your armchair and work out that, you know, God would have made the world in such and such a way, with the earth at the center and everything in a perfect circle around it. You've got to go look, observe, measure, because there is a God, and you're not him. And today, actually, I also think that Christianity provides a better grounds for science than atheism. Because at the end of the day, if you believe that the human brain came about through natural selection alone, and there was no overall guiding intelligence, then you believe that the human brain was basically designed to get you away from danger, to get you to food, to get you to a mate. But it was not designed to work out how the planets go around the sun. It was not designed to teach you about subatomic particles. It was not designed to answer any of these questions. And when you look at the history of science, most scientific theories in the past have failed. So it would be very easy for somebody to draw the conclusion, well, you know, maybe most of our current theories will fail. Maybe science doesn't take us to the truth, because after all, we've got these great big cognitive engines in between our ears, but they weren't designed by anybody. They've just been cobbled together over the eons. And they're really not designed to teach us the truth about the universe. They're just designed to propagate our species, to keep us, you know, to keep our selfish genes moving along. So if you believe in a designer, if you believe in a creator God, if you believe that God made you to understand this world which he created, then you've got motivation and an intellectual justification to pursue science. If you believe that the atoms just shuffled around and out we popped, now, okay, I mean, it's more complicated than that in evolution by natural selection. But when it comes to issues like understanding the universe, subatomic particles, quantum physics, general relativity, all these very subtle, grandiose views of the universe, our brains weren't designed for that sort of thing at all. They were designed to get us away from saber-toothed tigers and to get us to meet and to find a mate. And that's what our brains were inverted commas, designed to do. If you put that in quote marks. And so to me, the Christian historically only Christianity could have given birth to science, but I think only Christianity can really give you any intellectual justification to continue to pursue it. There seems to be a great big blind spot in contemporary atheism, in that they have this tremendous faith in the scientific worldview, but they seem to cut off the branch that they're sitting on. They seem to be saying this scientific worldview is wonderful and it tells us about everything, and it tells us that our brains and all our cognitive equipment was put together. Well, it wasn't overseen. It just sort of came together as the best job nature could do over the millennia, over the eons. So it really, I think Christians need to really, really, really make atheists think much harder about science. And whenever they raise the issue of science, we need to be saying, look, I'm glad you raised the issue of science. Do you understand how important Christianity is for the history of science? Do you understand how important Christianity is for even justifying the pursuit of science today? Those are questions Christians need to grasp with both hands. And there are plenty of resources online and on bookshelves and in bookstores for pastors, youth leaders, parents, everyone to be grabbing and getting into.
But how do you get pastors and parents and youth leaders, how do you get Christians in this epoch of time interested in the intellectual arguments? I mean, it seems to me that in so many churches we are entertaining our kids to death as opposed to educating them. I remember, I'm father of 12 children. We grew up in Southern California. And my kids used to complain about some of the churches that they were in They said if we wanted to go rock climbing or if we wanted to be entertained to death, we'd go to Disney World or Knott's Berry Farm. We want to learn something, and the churches simply were not educating children. They were babysitting children.
Oh, I'm really, really, really glad you said that, because I could not agree more. I worry about evangelicalism as an evangelical, but I worry about the future of it. And a friend who I discussed a lot when I was writing my book, Peter Maher, is a great fella and a teacher as well. And as we've been talking to young people, and as I listen to a lot of young people talking to me, as my job's teaching teenagers, there are a lot of teenagers out there who, by the time they are hitting their late teens, are incredibly frustrated that the church is not providing answers to questions that they have. They are aware that the answers are there. I'm not talking about a drove of young people who are prepared to lose their faith. I'm just talking about young people who are despondent and frustrated in that they want to understand their faith more deeply. They want to understand how to reach out to others outside. They want to be able to bring their friends to church and have their friends' questions answered. And churches really are more interested in what you've described as babysitting. I think this is to do with parents afraid of losing their youngsters, parents afraid that their youngsters will drift away from church. And a young person sitting at the back of the church, if my teenager is sitting beside me in church, there's something visible that I can see, and that can convince me that, you know, their heart's really in the faith. But unfortunately, the only way that you can know a young person has really committed their life to Christ is the life that they will lead when your eye isn't on them. And it might be frightening, but really, we have to start teaching Christianity as if we mean it, as if the answers which we are providing are important, that it is important that young people understand them. And we need to do that passionately, and we need to do that persuasively, because if we are not doing that, they will leave us eventually anyway, and they will be leaving us with less of a chance of return. Humanly speaking, you know, speaking as a human being, if a young person leaves your church in their early 20s and they've just been entertained, the odds of them coming back to you are very, very small. Now, I know, you know, God has a plan that we can't see into, and he can create all sorts of circumstances that we can't predict. But from the point of view of human wisdom, it is insane to entertain your child up until the age of 19. Because if their heart wasn't in the faith to begin with and they drift away, how are you ever going to pull them back? We need to really, you know, really, really talk as if the Word of God means something, that there was a reason for God to call his Son the Word. And to begin the Gospel of John with, it was, the, you know, in the beginning was the Word. Words matter. Truth matters. These things are at the heart of the faith, and we have got to start taking this much more seriously. Christianity is not a lifestyle and cannot be sold as a lifestyle. We have got to get it through to young people. We've got to get it through to parents that this matters because it's true and because it's real. And the challenge of the Christian life and the excitement of the Christian life, to be honest, is found in day-to-day life, living out those answers and living out the Word of God and trying to live that in your life day-to-day. It is not found in the few small hours that we spend in church. And if we try to generate excitement there, we miss the actual excitement of the Christian life is when you leave prepared and you go out and you lead it. That's where the challenge comes. That's where the battle begins. That is where you really feel your faith and where your faith is tested. We seem to be living in a culture that just does not want that to happen to our young people. We want to get our young people into churches. We want to get them away from intellectual challenges. We want to get them away from, you know, meeting anything that we don't control, because in case we might lose them. And my worry is that we're really not getting the faith out there, that there are lots of Christian young people who really don't understand what I would have called the basics of the gospel when I was a young person, and what probably could have been described as fundamentalist Protestantism, I would have said I would have a much better understanding of the Christian faith than what a lot of evangelical Christians, young people, have now. It's really quite worrying.
I think something else that needs to be addressed is that while truth matters, we could argue that life matters more. And what I mean by that is the map is not the territory, the menu is not the meal. And so we have to, on the one hand, arm our youth with good apologetic arguments. But on the other hand, we have to let them know that this is about an experience that they can have with a living Christ that is far more vibrant, far more enriching, far more significant than anything that the world has to offer, that we ultimately fill a God-shaped vacuum with God and with life in the Trinity, being partakers, as Peter put it, of the divine nature.
Yes, yes, yes. It's funny, as I was just reading through the Bible, I came across that text the other day, and it hits you like a bolt from the blue. Other Christian traditions might be much more switched into this than the evangelical tradition is. But that text, it just comes from you. We've been reading through, you know, Paul, all of a sudden you get Peter saying this to you. It wakes you up, and there is a tremendous excitement in that. I mean, it is extraordinary, the love of God. And it's extraordinary, the God that put this universe together, the God the Son becomes incarnate, comes down to meet with us, and the humility and the love there, and then the fact that you can know him and be brought into that loving relationship that the Father has with the Son, that the Spirit can bring us into, getting into that life and reflecting on that, and like you said, experiencing that, can be tremendously exciting and can be tremendously empowering and can lift people up in the most difficult of circumstances. If I talked about the importance of modeling and the importance of Christian young people having role models, one of the issues that we have with young people are obviously intellectual objections to the faith, but the other issue that we have is cynicism. And the idea that somehow there is no real goodness in this universe. There's only selfishness and worldviews that will let you down in the end. You know, no matter what you buy into, it's going to let you down in the end. It's going to fall apart. There's a tremendous cynicism that comes across in the Hollywood culture, that comes across in the films it produces. If you can introduce a Christian young person to an older Christian who's facing tremendous difficulties, who's facing illness, who's facing all sorts of horrible situations, and their faith keeps them buoyant, their faith strengthens them, their faith is real and living, then that is something real and tangible that a Christian young person can see and get to know and can understand, that this is not just a set of pat answers that are handed down by an apologist or a teacher or a pastor, that this is real and this is living and it does not let you down. And again, the key there is not having a lot of events in your church. The key there is that the young person actually really genuinely knows people in the church, and that there are people in the church whose faith is mature, and that the young people can look at and look up to and aspire to be like, because that person has maybe had a life and faith with Christ that they haven't had, and that's something that they want to pursue. And so the simple importance there of Christian fellowship, but you have to genuinely know the person. This cannot be Christian fellowship in the sense of we all had a nice day out or we all had a wonderfully exciting youth event. Those things can be fine in their place. But, you know, we need to get past the style and get to the substance and ask, what are we really looking for here? And I can think of older Christians that, through their lives, spoke to me. Not necessarily through anything that they even said. I can't remember what they said. I can think back to my own grandfather. And it's not so much what he said, but how he lived and the impact that would have on me. So, yes, we do need to get life out there. We need to get, we need to show the importance of the Christian life and enthuse Christian young people to get to know Christians, to get to know older Christians who have lived this out, and kind of explain to them and show them through their lives just how important it is to know Christ. Just for, like you said, to know that this is real and sustaining and powerful. Those things are very important.
What's your story, Graham? What context did you grow up in? How did you get to the point of teaching, particularly teaching issues with respect to apologetics and writing a book like New Atheism?
I grew up in a Brethren church in East Belfast, in a working class area, and my father and my grandfather would have been Brethren. So I think it would be fair to call it fundamentalist. And in fact, when I asked my dad about fundamentalist, I remember when I was going into Bible college, I did my degree in theology, and coming across for the first time the degree between evangelicalism and fundamentalism, and going home in great pride saying to my dad, you know, I'm an evangelical, I'm not a fundamentalist. And he was quite happy to be called a fundamentalist. He had no difficulty with that at all, because to him it was back to the original, you know, the books, the fundamentals. He was quite aware of that. So that would have been my background, but there was a strand of anti-intellectualism there. There's one pastor in Belfast who was famous for telling people they could take their degrees to hell with them. And an idea that somehow, if you know, you maybe don't want your young people getting a university degree because they'll lose their faith. So I probably had a lot of intellectual doubts when I was a teenager, which didn't help me. I was quite an anxious teenager. That got me interested in reading apologetics. George MacDull, I think, was probably one of the first books I lifted down and read, and was absolutely astonished to find that there were answers to these questions. And in a way brought the faith to life to me in ways that I found quite surprising, because once you start reading about the history of Palestine and you start saying, you know, an argument for the truth of the Bible is that Jesus fits that historical context, all of a sudden you're putting this into flesh and blood history in your head, and it comes to life in ways that I found really mind-opening and very inspiring. So from that stage, you know, I couldn't get enough of this sort of book. When I went to university, a guy I met there was David Glass. He's written a book, Atheism's New Clothes. And David and I, he now lectures at University of Ulster in computing and maths, but his PhD is in physics. He's, you know, he's postgraduate degrees in philosophy. And he and I have really had a friendship really going back over 20 years. We've both been very passionate in trying to get these ideas out there and to try and get the church to see the importance of dealing with these issues, of reasoning with unbelief. And it can be difficult in Northern Ireland. You know, it can be difficult, and it can be a long, slow battle at times, because there's still that wee bit of suspicion of anything that seems too academic in many churches. We believe it's an important work, and we keep ploughing on as best as we possibly can, and continuing to write and to continue to try and do talks and get out to churches. If you get near the universities, people would be more open to you. But that would be roughly my background, coming from a fundamentalist and a more sort of evangelical Baptist view of things. But really, I do feel within evangelicalism as a whole, and talking to people in different denominations and talking to, and really having a look at what's going on over the Atlantic, there does seem to be a little bit of a, I don't know if you can have a small crisis, but I think there is a worry, a small worry, that there's a crisis brewing here, in that we're not doing a great job of communicating, you know, the truth of Christianity. And the case for Christianity, but first and foremost, the actual truths that we need to defend to young people. So that would be roughly my background.
Yeah, and sometimes, I think too, Graham, we've made the Christian faith transactional as opposed to transformational. You know, the idea that you get a quick profession, and after you've made the profession, you get a car that gets you out of hell and gets you into heaven, And now you live as a baptized secular humanist. And this gets back to what you were saying earlier. I mean, if you look at Christians and what they're modeling, are they really modeling a transformational lifestyle? Or is this just a transaction that gets me into heaven and I can live just like the culture lives? And when the kids see that, they think, look, there's no difference between the culture. It's maybe a little bit more prudish and backwards, but there's no real big difference between the way my parents, my school teachers, my pastor, my youth pastor, there's no real big difference between them and the world after the transaction is all said and done.
Yeah. I mean, the part of the difficulty here is that from a middle class, upper middle class parent's point of view, evangelical Christianity can actually seem like a good deal. If you think about it, you know, if your child follows the evangelical Christian lifestyle, they're going to stay away from drink, they're going to stay away from drugs, they're going to, you know, be in less danger of STDs, and there are all sorts of benefits that a teenager might look at and say, well, that's boring, but a parent will look at and say, that's wonderful. And so we go through the process of, they go through the transaction, they, you know, you put your hand up, you do your, you know, you pray your prayer, you pretend you're in, and you can fit into a very comfortable lifestyle, which is very good educationally for a lot of young people. A lot of young people do very well because they're staying away from these negative influences. And at the end of the day, part of the difficulty is that there's no real cost. There's nothing where you're saying to anybody, look, this is going to actually cost you something as you live your life. You know, you know, there's places that you're not going to be allowed to go, not in the sense of, you know, there's. I'm not suggesting there's some sort of legalistic checklist that we have to go through here. But in the sense of, there are certain forms of entertainment that are not going to be healthy, and you would know they're not healthy, so you're just going to have to, in your own wisdom, say no to those. But it's also going to be much more important. Much more importantly, you're going to have to put charity, love, the greatest virtue, above success. You're not going to be allowed to be a ruthless business person, for example. You know, you're not going to be as ruthless as the next guy. You're just going to have to make a change to who you are as a person. And the world might be having a rat race, and you will be putting yourself at a deliberate disadvantage in that rat race, because you're going to say, no, I'm going to love my enemies. we're not prescribing foolishness here, but what I am saying is that there's a real difference that Christianity should make to the individual character. That if we read the New Testament correctly, it's saying, listen, this is going to cost you when you walk out into the world. And that part of the equation is not discussed. It's brushed under the carpet. And what we're left with is this very nice lifestyle, which is very reassuring to a lot of parents. And yeah, I mean, I'm the father of a teenage boy. And where my son goes in future years, I would love to be able to set out a plan where I could say, you know, yeah, I'll keep him at this church because they've got this sort of entertainment in that place. But the problem is, how could you ever know that faith was real? And if you don't teach him that, look, you've got a faith, and look, it's going to cost you something, and sometimes it'll cost you friendship groups, because they'll want to go places and do things and be with people and have life goals that you can't have. And while you might really want to stay in with that friendship group, and while you might even love them as friends, just as time goes on, people do generally drift apart a bit. And it's costly. The Christian life can be costly. And we don't really explain that to our young people. And I think J.C. Ryle said, whenever you need to preach the cross, the cost. But whenever you talk about the cost, then you can talk about the rewards as well. But you do need to do both. And in his book on holiness, he's very clear that you need to do both. Talk about the cost, and yes, then immediately go on and talk about, yes, but why that is worth it. You know, this isn't the cost that you paid or somehow earned your salvation. Salvation is a free gift. But yes, you're called to lift up your cross then and follow him. But that's worth it. And here's why. And these are all things that we need to be saying. We need to preach the whole message honestly. But if we just offer our young people a lifestyle, the first danger is that we will lose a lot of our young people. The second danger is that we will frustrate a lot of Christian young people who are looking for something deeper. But the greatest danger is that a lot of people will buy into that lifestyle and nothing else. And we just perpetuate a social club. That's the danger. And I think every denomination and every part of God's church will face those sorts of challenges. But I do worry somewhat that we can end up with churches that could go on going through the motions for generation after generation, and how many people have just bought into something which is comfortable and culturally reassuring, instead of what's really at the heart of Christianity. That's the difficulty.
And I think, too, to some degree, a lot of churches have bought into sort of a defeatist mentality. We're living at the end of the age. Christ is going to come back at any moment, and therefore we've kind of lost the culture wars, but we're going to get raptured, and whatever else happens, we don't have to worry about. And so this defeatist mentality really belies the Christian ethic, that one word of truth, as Solzhenitsyn put it, can outweigh the entire world. That one person, the power of one person can make a difference. We can have a Daniel moment. We can have a Lydia moment. There are epic swings in human history, and we can't give in to the defeatist mentality because of what we see around us. I mean, I heard a pastor say the other day, look, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that Christ is going to come back at any moment, because all you have to do is look at the newspaper. It's obvious. And if you have that kind of a mentality, then I don't think that you are marked out for transforming culture, which we're called to do.
That's right. That's right. And I think the other get-out-of-jail-free card that we cling to here in Northern Ireland, I would imagine it would be the same in some parts of the United States, is revival. It's okay, God will send revival. The words of the hymn here, send a revival, Lord, start the work in me. People aren't so keen on that second part. But the idea is that God will do something that will get us out of this, and it'll either be a rapture or a revival. The difficulty with saying is this is obviously the end times, is that, yes, I mean, Christianity may be taking a cultural hammering in the West, but if you look at the church in other parts of the world, there's tremendous signs for hope. And people in those parts of the world might be saying, listen, we've got a harvest to bring in here, so, you know, don't be so quick to assume that the entire church is to be viewed through Western lenses. So that's something that people need to keep in mind. But, there's Luther's famous saying that if he's told that Christ was coming back tomorrow, he'd plant an apple tree today, which is something that I mull over my head from time to time. If you have met somebody who has been brutalized or who has had a horrendous childhood or life through cruelty or neglect or abuse, you will be absolutely astonished to find how much meaning they find in the simple acts of kindness that they have experienced in their life from different people and how much that's meant to them. And one thing that I try to get through to people is never underestimate the power of a simple act of kindness. Now, how many times do you multiply that out when you're taking a message of God's kindness, Christ's kindness, you know, God the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, their kindness and love? You know, how much more do you multiply out the comfort and the joy that can bring to somebody who's broken? So for the church just to sit back and to say, well, you know, we're just going to ride this out to the second coming, it's actually an act of extraordinary cruelty, never mind faithlessness to our master, because there are people out there who need that word. Now, again, I speak as a man, I speak as a human being. I believe that the God has plans and his providence that we know little about, and I'm not suggesting that, you know, that this God's plan relies on my effort, but we have to remember his challenge to Ezekiel. You know, if people don't hear the word because you do nothing, I'm going to treat it like it's your fault. I mean, there is a responsibility placed on us here, and for us not to carry the gospel out to the broken person in front of us, the broken person that we meet, the neighbour that we meet on the road, on the way in our lives, is an act of extraordinary cruelty almost. Because there are people out there who desperately need the life and love that God can bring. And there's a world out there that desperately needs the truth that we have to bring. And yes, as you transform lives, you automatically transform culture. And you have to put some thought into that. You can't just assume that it's all going to fall into place. There has to be wisdom here. But yes, we need to be reaching out to people around us. We need to be reaching out, you know, with the message of God's word. And not in the sense of, you know, pray this prayer after me and then I'm just going to move on because that's you saved. We're fine. We're done with you. Attend church once a week. And, you know, there needs to be a continual building up and comforting and supporting people throughout their Christian life that we need to really labor very hard on. Very, very, very hard. You know, Paul talks about, you know, our faith inspired by hope and our labor prompted by love. We need to have a labor that will just continually go on where we might not be able, say the culture wars are over and they're lost. Assume, I don't think they are, but suppose that's them gone. That does not mean that God's working for his people has in any way stopped. You continue to reach out and you continue to preach and you continue to challenge falsehood because those falsehoods are cruel and they will break people. And they will splinter their lives into pieces, and they need to be challenged. We need to challenge falsehood when we find it, and we need to challenge the culture around us. And if God sends a time of healing for the culture and the tide changes, you know, that's in God's plan, but we need to labour on because that's what God calls us to do. And there are people who are desperately broken, desperately lost, or desperately blind, or all three. And they need what Christ has done for them, and they need it explained to them persuasively, and they need it offered to them rationally, and they need it offered to them by somebody who cares for them genuinely, genuinely knows them, genuinely cares for them, and will be there for them come what may.
You know, when I listen to the passion in your voice as you're explicating this, it reminds me of the fact that you have a particular interest in the moral argument for God, and that's very much related to what you're talking about.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, I mean, the idea that morality can, in any sense, be explained without God, particularly from the point of view of atheism, I actually find that very implausible. I think that the real issue here comes down to how can morality be first of all, how can we trust our moral intuitions at all if our brains have been assembled by natural selection, if our brains have been assembled by some sort of random process? Why trust any of our moral intuitions? Now, even Dawkins in The God Delusions calls morality a blessed, precious mistake. Now, the interesting thing there is that he's saying that basically natural selection has primed our brains to be compassionate because if you're a compassionate person, it displays to a potential mate that you've got a lot of resources, that you are somebody who can offer a potential mate a lot in terms of the riches that you have. But also there's a bit of tit-for-tat going on. You scratch my back, I scratch yours. So there's all these things, he says, that are going on in evolution by natural selection that have really created this thing called morality, which isn't terribly efficient. It's not a terribly efficient thing. It does lead people to do things like to lay down their lives for strangers or even for their enemies. And it does. But in that sense, it's a mistake. But he calls it a precious mistake. Now, if he's going to be consistent, he can't put in that word precious. He can't do that. It's not precious, unless he just means in the sense of a matter of taste and the way that somebody, you know, might like fine wine as opposed to good beer. You know, he just happens to like morality. But I don't think he means that because he continually moralizes people who disagree with him. So he sees morality as something good. But my question is, well, Richard, why would you trust any of your moral intuitions if you see morality as a mistake, as a perspective of the process that created it? You know, why do you value your moral intuitions? Unless somebody has designed us and give us some sense of what's right and wrong, well, you know, unless that's happened, we really shouldn't be trusting our consciences at all. But secondly, why does Richard Dawkins moralize so much? I mean, he honestly believes that there's some sort of moral, but if you get involved, you listen to him, he believes that people ought to agree with him, you know, rationally ought, but also morally ought, because he basically sees religion as dangerous. And therefore, it's something that we need to get rid of because it's morally wrong to bring people up in religious environments. Now, where does that moral ought come from? I mean, why? Yes, there may be all sorts of moral values in there. But, you know, if an artist decides that he wants to leave his wife and go off to Tahiti and paint beautiful paintings there, and he ignores his obligations to his wife and child, we might enjoy the art, but we condemn the artist because there are other goals than his artistic success. There are other goals than beauty. There are moral oughts that outweigh those considerations. So a politician who decides, well, the refugees that are coming into my, you know, are coming into my country, or the country that I want to invade to get their resources, those people, they might, the people that would be hurting me pursuing that policy, they might matter, but my success is a rational consideration too. And we would condemn the politician who puts his personal success over and above the lives of people who he might affect, or if he put his own personal success above the lives of the citizens he was elected to take care of, we would condemn that person. Because there are moral oughts that outweigh self-interest. There are moral oughts that outweigh artistic interest, that outweigh every other sort of interest. But the big question is, why? You know, where does this weight, where does this force come from? Where does obligation come from? And you really can only have obligations to a person. And so to my mind, the best explanation by far here is that morality is really, or that morality is best explained as the commands of God, or the will of God, or God's desire for our life, or something along those lines. We need a lawgiver here if there are going to be moral laws. There needs to be a moral lawgiver. So I think even if you read the New Atheism and you begin to look at their moralizing, there are two big questions there that I think Dawkins needs to answer. Now, there are many, many more, but those are the two I would bring out first and foremost. Joe Richard, why would you trust any of your moral intuitions, given that you think that the cognitive device in between your ears that produces those intuitions was sort of assembled without any real design in mind, and certainly not with morality in mind, and that you think morality is inefficient? And given that you think morality is inefficient, why do you find it so powerful? How do you explain the power of morality? Why is it that you pay so much attention to moral obligations? Because they seem to be inescapable. Moral obligations are inescapable. We can't live without them. We can't ignore them. But the difference is this. I can explain moral obligation. I can explain the power of conscience. Richard Dawkins can't. He's got to live by it. He's stuck with it. But he can't explain it. And so to that extent, I think the moral argument for the existence of God is extremely powerful. And it's certainly something that I have found that helped me a lot as a Christian young person with doubts over the years. It's one that I have found very, very useful.
You know, you talk about this near pressure. It almost seems to me, even though we're not supposed to take on this particular motif and sneer at a Dawkins, but when I think about what you have just explicated, I oftentimes think, you know what? A guy like Alex Rosenberg, who wrote The Atheist Guide to Reality, Enjoying Life Without Illusions, is far more upfront and honest with his students. He happens to be a professor of philosophy at Duke University. And he just bites the bullet. He says there's no purpose to the universe. There's no meaning to life. You're here just as a function of dumb luck. There's no such thing as metaphysical realities like souls. There's no such thing as free will. There's no difference between right or wrong, good or bad. He embraces the logical implication of his worldview.
Yes. I think that he's very consistently nihilistic, and I think he's to some extent applauded for that. I think one solution he suggested once for this, you know, how should somebody deal with such a bleak worldview, and I think his line was, we'll try Prozac.
That's exactly what his line was. That's right, yeah.
Yeah, it's not really livable. I think would be my simple answer to that, and I'm not sure. I mean, I think Francis Schaeffer actually would probably have suggested, well, can you live that way? And I think Francis Schaeffer's approach to that sort of argument is probably the best one. Well, that's very easy to say, but can you really live like that? It's a bit like a man saying, here's my view of life, I strongly believe in it, but it's probably mistaken. You can't believe both of those things at the same time. You either believe that this is your worldview or you believe it's probably mistaken. There's a contradiction there. And I would wonder if Alex Rosenberg can really live that way, if he can really consistently maintain those beliefs. I would have thought it would have been nigh on impossible. Given that even sociopaths will acknowledge that there's a moral force that they really ought to feel more strongly about, but don't. I would say that would be a fairly unlivable philosophy. But I do think it's what they're left with. And also, I mean, and obviously, my other argument against Alex Rosenberg and his point of view is, well, again, you're saying that the human brain was assembled by a process that was really that really benefits species that can reproduce and survive and pass on their genes. Now, that process gives us brains that are very good, but from your point of view, should be good at, you know, helping us getting away from predators and that sort of thing. Now, those brains were not designed for science, but I'll tell you what they definitely were not designed for, and that's metaphysics. They definitely were not designed to get at life, the universe, and the meaning of everything. That's not in the evolution's wheelhouse at all. So why do you trust your brain to tell you that nihilism's true? Now, he really is on a very sticky wicket, I think, because if he's trying to embrace this scientific worldview where everything is just matter in motion, well, I suppose that's putting it crudely, but if he wants to take that very, very, you know, strong worldview, where mind has absolutely no place at all, and morality has no place at all in that worldview, it's all about the stuff that science can verify, that science can cope with, that would fit sensibly into that sort of materialistic worldview, then if you're going to go down that materialistic line, I really think that you are in big trouble, because you're suggesting your brain was created by a materialistic process that was never designed to let you know if things like materialism were true. You know, you're making a big claim about metaphysical truths, and your brain was in no way prepared to deal with that if you believe evolution by natural selection is the only show in town when it comes to explaining the human brain.
I was just flipping through your book as you were talking, New Atheism, the Survival Guide, and something that I had underlined a long time ago is your statement that Dawkins hypothesizes that chance plus evolution plus billions of opportunities on Earth like planets explains appearance of design in the living world. That hypothesis leads to a prediction. Even if we found trillions of Earth-like planets, the majority would be lifeless. A small fraction would have bacterial life. And we would only find conscious animals on the tiniest fraction. However, suppose we discovered that all of these planets were teeming with creatures like birds and mammals. Dawkins' hypothesis would be falsified. Why?
Right. So what Dawkins wants to say when it comes to the design of life is he talks about Mount Improbable. So on one side of Mount Improbable, you've got to imagine this as a very, very, very steep slope up one side, like a sheer cliff. And you stand at the bottom of Mount Improbable as a climber, and you think, I'm never going to be able to get up to the top of that mountain. But if you would just go round to the other side, you would see a long, gentle slope which you could make your way up with ease. There is a way up to the top of the mountain. Now, Dawkins would then come back round and say, well, if you take a single cell, and you look at a single cell, and at the other end of the spectrum you've got a human being, or a blue whale, or something majestic like that, you would say, well, there's no way that one cell by chance could somehow grow into that human being one day, could evolve into that human being by chance. But if you would just go round to the other side of Mountain Probable, and would look at even evolution by natural selection, you would say, yes, it's a huge leap to get from that one cell all the way up to humans. But it's not such a big leap to get from one cell to a slightly more complex cell, and then a slightly more complex cell yet, and then the multicellular animals. And if you keep moving by small steps, it's very easy to see how we can move with a little bit of luck at each stage all the way up to humans. And there are a number of problems with this argument. The first of all is that while each step involves just a little bit of luck in Dawkins' terms, those probabilities multiply out. So if it's a 90% chance that you will get up each step of Mountain Probable, if you multiply 90% by 90% by 90%, you keep moving along, you get to a very small percentage indeed. But on top of that, there are a number of steps that Dawkins says are extremely improbable. First of all, the origin of life itself. He sees that as a very low probability event. The first eukaryotic cells, he sees that as extremely improbable. And the development of consciousness, he sees that as extremely improbable. Now, at that stage, you're saying, well, hang on, Richard, if there's three very improbable events, how in any sense have you explained why there's conscious living human beings on Earth? Has evolution failed? And he says, no, not at all. There are billions and billions and billions of Earth-like planets out there. A small number of those will have life on them. A smaller number still will have eukaryotic cells, and on a much smaller number, again, you're going to have conscious animals, and I suppose on a much smaller number, you'll have maybe civilizations. So luck and natural selection explain everything, according to Richard Dawkins. Now, the first question is, where's your evidence for these worlds? He doesn't have any. We've found some Earth-like planets out there, but that basically means they've got water, or at least they're the right distance from a sunlight star that they've got water. We don't have any confirmation of life anywhere else in the universe. We certainly don't have any independent evidence for Earth-like planets in the sense that Dawkins means, and that's planets which are all capable of supporting a human civilization. Because that's what he needs to get this argument to work. He needs billions of Earth-like planets all capable of supporting an Earth-like civilization. So he has no evidence for that. But beyond that, he has actually made a hypothesis. He said that if we did find these billions of Earth-like planets, he can tell us proportions that most of them won't have life. Some will have single cells. They will have prokaryotic cells, smaller number of eukaryotic cells, and a smaller number of conscious animals. And he has made this remarkable prediction, which he has absolutely no evidence for. And my big problem here is that my understanding is that Darwin never offered his theory in the sense of, I'm going to explain the existence of complex life on billions and billions and billions of Earth-like planets. He suggested that this was he wanted this to be an explanation for life on Earth as we have it now. But he was trying to explain life on one planet, not on billions of planets. He would have been astounded at the size of the universe. He had no evidence for that at all. So if you were to go back and say, well, look, your explanation only works if we've got billions and billions and billions of Earth-like planets for this process to take part on, I think the answer would come back as, well, then this explanation really isn't working terribly well at all. There needs to be something more going on here then than just natural selection. We need to look for something beyond that. So I think the design argument is actually alive and well in the living world. And that works irrespective of your view of origins of species or of humans or whatever. But rather than get into those debates, I would just rather say to people, look, at the end of the day, there's a creator. You're just going to have to acknowledge that. And I think that there's the evidence for design to me seems to be as powerful as it ever was, and certainly hasn't been challenged in any strong way by the finding of science at all.
That's what I love about the intelligent design movement. I mean, intelligent design theorists are willing to follow the facts wherever they lead. And you have a person like Dawkins. Well, he starts with the presupposition that there cannot be the supernatural, so he has to continue coming up with these far-fetched ideas and then try to pawn them off on an unsuspecting public.
Yes. What I find very consistent here is that Dawkins can come up with a very weak argument and yet somehow remain culturally respectable. But if you're in any way attached to the intelligent design movement, you're some sort of pariah. And unfortunately, one aspect of these debates that I find very regrettable is the way that some Christian scientists who maybe aren't attached to the intelligent design movement, maybe because they are from a more theistic evolutionist point of view, or sometimes from on the more the old-fashioned conservative young earth creationist point of view, the way that some Christians have begun to speak about each other in this debate has not been helpful.
That's true.
Either questioning people's faith or their intellectual integrity, and I find that quite disheartening. I know intelligent design is a broad church and brings in more than just Christians. I mean, that has to be said. It's not a Christian movement per se, but there are Christians in there, and they're quite comfortable to designate themselves as Christians. And some of the things that I have read in book reviews and the like, it has got very, it has been unpleasant at times. And, there can be a civility within the academy that sometimes, between people who aren't Christians, that sometimes Christians don't obey when they talk about each other. And that has been a bit unfortunate. But again, to go back to your point, when you talk about Richard Dawkins, and he maintains his cultural respectability. But if you're in any way going to mention design, if you're going to allow the divine a foot in through the door, you're going to be a pariah to many people out there in the secular world who just seem to be absolutely terrified of anything that sounds vaguely religious in any sense.
Well, it's interesting when you look at his books. I mean, they're not really endorsed by historians and philosophers or intellectuals, but more likely by cultural icons.
Yes, and I think that explains an awful lot about the movement. If you look at the dust jacket and you see who endorses it, then it gives you an idea. So Darren Brown, who's a magician, I think, endorsed it. Ian McEwan, who's a novelist, wrote Atonement. I mean, we're not talking about historians of science. We're not talking about philosophers of science. Generally, when they reviewed it, Michael Ruse, for example, who would be... I mean, Michael Ruse is not... he's certainly not an ally of the Christian faith. He's an atheist, he argues for atheism. I mean, he felt Dawkins' book was terrible. The God delusion, that is, and was not particularly well argued. And he was hammered by Dawkins' followers at the time for saying this. But generally, people who Dawkins should have had as allies tended to read this book and say, look, this has not been well argued. This is not a good argument. And these are atheists. The standard line at this stage then was to call them appeasers, like Neville Chamberlain. And that's lovely to hear, because that would make you and me Hitler. But if you're going to in any way make excuses for Christians, if you're Neville Chamberlain, and this became the ridiculous argument that if you're even prepared to say that is a bad argument, that is a bad atheistic argument, that you were somehow betraying the atheistic cause, that tells you a lot about the mentality of Dawkins' arguments. I think that it is significant that the new atheism began to rise just as Twitter was getting off the ground. I think that's more than just a coincidence. I think it maybe speaks to the intellectual culture that we're moving in. I think it speaks to the mindset of many people out there, where put-downs and witticisms and insults and style matter so much more than a substantial, well-informed argument and good faith in that argument. Somebody making a reasonable point in good faith and in good conscience matters for very little in an age where you have to say something important in 140 characters, or 280 now if you're very important, but 140 characters, not 140 words, but 140 characters. That really only leaves you room for insults. That really only leaves you room for shallow invective. And I think that in many ways, the new atheism, some people see it as a response to September the 11th and the rise of religious fundamentalism. I think that played a part. I think the reason it was successful is that we were moving to a much shallower culture in the age of instant communication. And I do remember round about this time, I was noticing that atheists that I could have spoken to on email, atheists that I could have had long conversations with and sending emails backwards and forwards or talking to them on blogs and having long blog posts, gradually those conversations moved to Facebook, where they became more hostile, where people became much keener to preen a bit, to show off in front of others, to not look foolish. And whenever I tried to engage some of those people on Twitter, it just became impossible. There was no room for a conversation, and there were too many people watching. There was too much of an audience. And it was round about that stage that I noticed that it became almost impossible, really, to have a decent conversation with the atheists that I'd been able to reason with beforehand. So I think the rise of Twitter and the rise of the tweet and the rise of that sort of tabloid intellectual culture that we now live in, I think that explains to a large extent why New Atheism was able to get away with a lot of the rhetoric and with a lot of the weaves and the dodges and that helped them, you know, sell so many books and help them influence so many people.
That's really what you're talking about when you're talking about the new atheism. I mean, we've talked about fake news for several years now, but really what you're underscoring is that Twitter and these small character interchanges lead to fake arguments.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's a good way of putting it, actually. Yes. Yes. Fake intellectualism or fake arguments or fake truths or fake syllogisms, you know, it's just, it sells books, and unfortunately now we have sort of absorbed this in, and you know, I have been astonished by some of the things now that you will see coming across on YouTube that you will see portrayed as a reasonable, sensible argument. If you read William Lane Craig and then you go on and see some of the responses to him online, I mean, it just leaves you, you know, despairing over where intellectual discourse is going. And Bill Craig will quite often try and, you know, he's a serious, you know, academic, but he tries to bring things down to a popular level as well. So, I mean, that's the reason I mention him. So when it comes to the other apologists or general apologists, then, you know, it's going to be so much more difficult to get people to listen when the instinct is to not necessarily to look for a hole in somebody else's argument, where the instinct isn't to look for, you know, where's the logical weak points or can I spot a logical hole. Quite often the instinct is, how can I make a joke out of this? You know, how can I get a good one-liner and a bit of a zinger out of this? Can I make a funny video out of it in response to this argument from a serious academic? And that's quite worrying. And there's a bit of thought and a bit of skill goes into some of these videos. You know, in terms of creativity, in terms of their knowledge, how to use technology to produce a good video. I mean, these are not foolish people. They understand the technology. They understand the medium. You know, and when, in that sense, they're not foolish. But when it comes to just the basic courtesy of listening to what somebody else has to say, it's not there. It's not there. And Christians need to be careful we don't do the same thing. We cannot respond to unbelief by using the same strategy of you know, getting our own stand-up comedians and making our own zingers and making our own wee one-liners. We've got to follow the narrow path. We've got to present the truth faithfully and in love and conscientiously. And if you care for the person you're presenting the truth to, you will try to present them a good argument. You will not try to con them. You will try to show integrity, and you will try to show care and thought in what you're presenting to that person. Yes, you'll make mistakes, And yes, you're not to be afraid of making mistakes, because the person who you're talking to will have patience with you and will allow you those mistakes if they see that you're doing this with integrity and care and with their good in mind. If you try to appear very, very funny and very, very entertaining, you know, the second you make a mistake, if all you wanted to do was entertain, the other person will switch off. So characters, in my mind, things like character and prayer are at the heart of apologetics and evangelism. You know, the two go hand in hand nowadays, and that's something we really need to start getting across to young people.
You know, I wanted to bring it full circle with that very idea. That's exactly what I had in mind. How important apologetics is as the handmaiden to evangelism, God using your well-reasoned answer as a springboard or an opportunity to share the truth, the joy, the love, the peace, the experience you can have with the living God.
Yes, like I said, I mean, people have sometimes said to me, you know, I get this response in the evangelical churches, particularly from those of a more Calvinistic bent, you know, the only person who can, you know, why bother with apologetics? The only person who can call someone to faith is God. And my answer to that is, listen, have you looked at how many times in Scripture God reasons with unbelievers, where he sets out evidence in his Gospels and in the book of Acts, where he challenges the foolishness of unbelief? If you're going to communicate God's word effectively to unbelievers, you've got to take apologetics seriously. You have got to sit down and you've got to look at, how can I reason with an unbeliever? Because that's what God does. He reasons with unbelievers. And yes, he commands and he calls and he persuades and he does all those things, but reasoning is in there too. And we can't ignore that. And so apologetics, you know, just a reasoned defense for the faith that's within you, is at the very heart of what we do. And the other side of apologetics is that it brings the Christian faith to life in surprising ways. I talked earlier about the moral argument and the design argument. If you're taking those arguments seriously, you've got to sit down and say, you know, the God I worshipped is responsible for the design and structure of the universe. How great is that God? The God I worship is the source of all moral authority. So when I read his word, I have to take that seriously. Whenever I consider who he is and I worship him, this is who I'm worshiping, the source of all beauty, the source of all goodness. And I would certainly want to push the moral argument beyond just, you know, moral obligations. I would say that God's the source of all goodness. So when you start to really get to grips with apologetics and use that in your evangelism, it actually strengthens the Christian life. It's not an add-on to the Christian faith. It's not a little bit that we do extra. It's not something for, you know, a small sub-branch of evangelists. It's really about communicating the Christian faith faithfully to a world which is hostile to it. And you've got to communicate to this hostile world in a way that they can understand and in a way that challenges it and in a way that reasons with it and is in a way that is faithful to the way that God speaks to unbelief in his word. So I would argue that apologetics actually should bring you closer to God in your Christian life. It is not just a dry academic exercise. It is anything but. It is something that is vitally important to me as a Christian, and I think needs to be considered to be vitally important to the church. And, you know, going back to church history, it's been vitally important to the church fathers, vitally important, to Wesley, vitally important to so many key characters in church history, that to somehow void this out of our Christian life is a terrible mistake.
It's just beautifully said. I mean, I'm so glad that you brought what I like to call it post-evangelism. You have pre-evangelism, God using your well-reasoned answer as an opportunity to communicate the gospel. But as you've pointed out or alluded to, I mean, if you run into the winds and waves of doubt yourself along your Christian journey, then it is those arguments that fortify you, that allow you to say, you know what? I know God created the universe. I know that Jesus Christ is God and demonstrated he was God through the resurrection. I know that the Bible is a reliable authority. So these become pillars and posts to which you can cling.
That's right. And I mean, Alvin Van Tinkle, actually, I mean, a prominent philosopher, a Christian philosopher, he talks about, you know, waking up in the middle of the night with a sudden fear. What if it's not real? And you know, there's times in our lives, you know, we're caught unawares where a sudden doubt can suddenly hit you. And these things can be very, very, these things can be comforting and useful. And they've been so important to so many people in church history. And the more you get back into the early fathers and you look at how they reasoned and thought, this is just something that has never been alien to the Christian faith at all. For some reason, evangelicals have made it alien, I think, over the last century or half century. I'm not sure when it began. But this retreat from reason, it's not natural to the Christian life. It's not something that flows out of Scripture. It's not something that flows out of, you know, the first churches, the first people writing in the first churches. It seems to be quite recent. I wonder, is it an attempt to create a subculture for ourselves where we don't have to engage the world around us and where life can be lived out quite comfortably without having to worry too much about people who aren't really in our family circle or our network of friends? That's one possible explanation for it. You know, the old explanation was there was no room for it in the university, therefore the churches, you know, moved away from academics. But, I mean, there are so many, we have an embarrassment of riches now in academia when it comes to Christian academics, you know, who are writing about these sorts of issues. So why is it not filtered down to the church? Why is it that there's so much resistance to the you know, the wonderful research that's going on out there and not just research, but sermons and books? And why is there no response to the light and the warmth that's coming from Christian scholars? And I sometimes worry, is it because we'd have to move out of our comfort zone? We'd have to move out and use these arguments to address people who are hostile to us. That's a worry. That's a worry. But, you know, God's good and God has a plan, and, you know, we put our trust in him. And I think that these things are, you know, that a lot of the work that's been done recently has been done for a reason. And another thing I try to keep in mind is that God may have done this not to reach a handful of souls, for all I know. You know, God's love stretches beyond anything I can imagine. So, you know, none of this goes to waste. All of this is in God's plan. But I do think there's a challenge to the evangelical culture out there. Is, you know, guys, what are we doing with so much of the embarrassment of riches that God has given us at the minute? Why are we not using this to challenge people outside of our own subculture? Why are we spending so much time attacking each other online and not trying to reach out to those who don't share our faith? What is going on in evangelicalism here? It's a question that a lot of people are asking, and I think it deserves a serious answer.
It does. The tribalism is mind-numbing, and I am so delighted that I ran across you as a result of your book, New Atheism, A Survival Guide. Graham, you have really blessed everybody listening in, and again, I'm very grateful for the work that you do and for communicating in an interesting way and reaching a whole new level, a whole new stratum of millennials that may otherwise never encounter these arguments or engage them. So thank you. It's just great to know you.
Thank you very much, Hank. It's been very, very good talking to you. It's been a very real blessing.
Well, bless you, Graham, and hope you get through the snowstorm.
I'm sure we'll survive. Maybe get a snow day tomorrow if I'm lucky.
Yeah, of course.
Centimeters here, so you don't know my luck.
Of course. Well, good talking to you, and thanks again for your contribution to the Hank Unplugged podcast. Do remember, you can go to iTunes or wherever you consume your favorite podcasts and rate and review. But a great action step that you can take right after listening is go to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating. Look, I'm truly keeping my word when I say I'm bringing interesting, innovative, inspirational, intelligent people to you so that you can listen to what they're communicating. You can learn from what they're communicating, and you can take what you have learned to make an impact. Remember, only one life. Soon 'twill be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. I mean, there are no do-overs. I'm 67 right now, and I think so often about every single day of my life. How am I using my life in a way that is productive for the kingdom? Because one day, I'll stand before God and give an account for what I did while I was here. You know, the gospel's free. It'll cost you your life. You're not your own. You've been bought with a price. Those aren't trite cliches. These are truths. There are degrees of reward in heaven. Jesus said, do not labor for that which perishes, but labor for that which is eternal. And I'm going to leave you with those words. And once again, my thanks to Graham Veal. If you would like a copy of his book, New Atheism, a Survival Guide, you can pick it up on the web at equip.org. It's available for those who support the ministry. You can also write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271, or talk to one of our resource consultants, 888-7000, and the letters CRI. We're out of here for this Hank Unplugged podcast, but we're going to be back with many, many more. So please go to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, give us a review, and you'll be taking an action step that's making a difference in the lives of people all over the planet. Thanks. God bless you. Look forward to seeing you next time with more of Hank Unplugged.